I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk about the evolution of the human brain, and in particular, how shifts in gene regulation may have influenced this. So our closest living ancestor are chimpanzees, and unlike what's commonly thought, we didn't evolve from chimps, but instead the fossil record indicates that we evolved from a precursor maybe 5-7 million years ago. And this precursor organism then evolved into the present-day chimp and also the present-day humans. And various steps occurred along the way from what we know of the fossil record. And so, for example, one of the things that occurred was the ability to shift from walking on all fours to just 2 feet. And of course, something that's widely known is that there was a rather large increase in the size of the brain that occurred approximately 1 or so million years ago. And then various other steps occurred to lead to formation of the modern humans. So in the present day, how do human brains differ from chimpanzee brains? Well, one obvious difference is human brains are 3 times bigger. The prefrontal cortex, which is the center of higher cognitive abilities, is 5 times larger in humans than in chimps, and it's far more complex. And going along with this complexity, human brains are capable of things that chimp brains are not, such as, probably most notably, we have a very complex language, whereas chimpanzee language is rather rudimentary, and we're capable of higher cognitive functions like abstract thought. So the subject of my talk today is on the genetic changes that drove the differences between humans and chimps in terms of their brains. Now, we know that modern-day humans and chimps share about 99% of the same DNA. So the question is, which human sequences within the remaining 1% are responsible for human-specific brain traits? And another question is, how did these human sequences accomplish this task, this generation of human-specific traits? Well, Katie Pollard at UCSF some 20 years ago came up with the concept that key sequences that might be involved in this are human accelerated regions. This is the term she gave them, otherwise known as HARs. And these sequences are not genes, they're just simply sequences that are highly conserved, meaning that they almost certainly have a function because they're present in a large number of organisms. They're highly conserved, but they've rapidly evolved uniquely in the human lineage. And so the idea is that these sequences can direct human-specific traits. So since Katie Pollard defined the first HARs, many more have been defined by other groups, and together we now know there are about 3,000 HARs. Their average length is only 250 nucleotides, meaning they're very small, whereas by comparison, a typical protein coding gene is about 30,000 nucleotides in length. And so HARs are approximately 1/100 the size of a typical protein coding gene. Importantly, it was found that about 97% of HARs are in non-coding regions. So they're in the portions of the human genome that do not encode proteins. This includes regions within genes that do not encode the protein, so-called introns, and also the regions between genes, or vast distances between a lot of the genes in our genome with only non-coding DNA. Non-coding regions are dominated by volume controls that regulate the expression of specific genes. So even though they're not coding, they're very important. And together, this led to the hypothesis that human-specific traits may have been largely conferred by changes in gene regulation. Not necessarily changes in protein, but changes in the regulation of those proteins. And that's going to be my major theme of my talk today. In support of this hypothesis, about 1/2 of HARs that have been experimentally tested have been shown to be transcriptional enhancers. Transcriptional enhancers are essentially little volume controls that act positively to regulate genes that are some distance from them. They often act in a temporal and a spatial specific way during development, meaning they act on only certain cells and at certain developmental time points. And today I'm going to talk about a HAAR that has enhancer activity, and it has characteristics suggesting that it has roles in driving human-specific neural traits. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about a HAAR called HAAR123 that we showed is a neural enhancer. Some of the evidence for this is shown in the lower right, where you can see the expression of a reporter driven by HAAR. The reporter gives a blue color, and you can see expression in the brain and in the spinal cord. HAAR123 is an intron, that is a non-coding region within the SMUG6 gene, and SMUG6 is part of a key component of a biochemical pathway critical for neural development, and that's why we decided to focus on it. It's also of interest because HAAR123 is in a neural disease locus that, when either deleted or amplified, is strongly associated with a variety of neural diseases. So like all other HAARs, HAAR123 is relatively ancient. It's found in a lot of species. It's found in all what I'll call standard mammals, the eutherians. It's also found in the kind of mammal that's commonly found in Australia, marsupials like kangaroos. It's not, however, found in monotremes, the prototype being a platypus. And so that this places HAAR123 is probably evolving about 150 million years ago. So it's been around for 150 million years. But what's interesting is it is rapidly changed in sequence since humans and chimps diverged. There's 9 nucleotide differences, which is quite a lot of difference considering it's only 442 nucleotides long, and there's only about a 7 million year gap between these two species. By contrast, non-human primates, such as orangutans, old world monkeys, gorillas, they have almost no changes between sequence. Many of them have zero changes within the HAAR123 sequence. So this indicates that HAAR123 is specifically shifting in sequence in humans, which then leads to the hypothesis that these changes were selected for because they conferred a human-specific trait, one or more human-specific traits. To figure out what HAAR123 does, which we thought would be the most important question, we knocked it out in embryonic stem cells, in particular human embryonic stem cells, to relate it to our interest, which is its role in humans. So the beauty of embryonic stem cells is they can generate all the cells in the body. And what I'm going to do here is show you in a cartoon fashion what our evidence shows that HAAR123 does in the cells that are derived from embryonic stem cells. And I'm going to show it to you in a cartoon fashion, and then I'll later show you some of the evidence for this. So one thing that we found is that HAAR123 is critical for the very first differentiation event in embryonic stem cells, where they form ectoderm, or mesoderm, or endoderm. These are the three primary germ layers. And we found that HAAR123 is specifically critical for forming what's called ectoderm or neuroectoderm. These are two terms for the same thing. It is not required for it, but it promotes this. It very strongly then promotes the next step, which is generation of neuroprogenitors from neuroectoderm. Neuroectoderm can also form other kinds of tissues. We haven't tested that, but we do know that it's very important for forming neural progenitors. And then lastly, it also affects the ratio of cells that are generated from neural progenitors. Everyone knows that the brain has neurons, but the human brain has a roughly equal number of glial cells, which are non-neuronal cells that are very important for brain function. HAAR123 controls the ratio of neurons to glial cells. So as I said, I'm going to go through a little bit of the evidence for what I've depicted in this cartoon. So let me start by talking about HAAR123's role in promoting neural progenitor formation. What I have showing here is single-cell seq analysis, which in brief is a way of depicting lots of cells, in this case roughly 10,000 cells, each shown by a dot, in a two-dimensional space, using an algorithm, we can assign the cells in two-dimensional space. And basically, related cells tend to cluster together. And what we have here are three neural progenitor populations in three different colors. What we've analyzed here are embryonic stem cells that have been pushed to neuroectoderm and then pushed to form neural progenitors. So it's in the midst of the neural formation stage. And that's why you see these three NPC subsets. Now, if you compare wild-type ES cells to HAR123 knockout cells, you see a dramatic difference. One difference is you see very few of two of the neural progenitor subsets. Only a few cells make it to the stage. You see an accumulation of early ectoderm, a neuroectoderm, meaning those cells haven't progressed because of the knockout. And you also see a knockout-specific cell subset that our evidence suggests is an intermediate towards forming more mature neural progenitors. Altogether, this provides evidence that HAR123 is critical for neural progenitor formation. Now, I mentioned that also HAR123 plays a role in neuroglial ratio, so let's take a look at that. Neurons are the cells that I think most of us are familiar with. They're the functional units of the nervous system. Glial cells provide support to the neurons. They do lots and lots of things that I don't have time to discuss today, but they're extremely important as neurons in the brain. If you look here, you can see that when we knocked out HAR123, took those cells and differentiated them to the point where they make neurons and glial cells, you can see that wild-type cells indeed have neurons are marked by a marker called TUB3, and glial cells marked by GFAP. But you look in the knockout, you see a quite dramatic reduction in the number of neurons and an increase in the number of glial cells. Shown on the right is statistical analysis of several replicate experiments of this. And there's about a 2.5-fold shift in the ratio, which is a rather large change in ratio. And so this has lots of implications, which I don't really have time to talk about in detail. But one key point is it's known that the ratio of neurons and glial cells, for example, in the prefrontal cortex, is quite different between humans and chimps. So this finding may relate to that. And it's also important to realize that the neuroglial ratio likely greatly contributes to brain complexity. More glial cells is supportive of more complexity. What about in vivo? So to this point of my talk, I've only been providing in vitro data. It's from humans, but it's in vitro. What about in vivo? Because it's not ethical to do knockout experiments in humans, we did this experiments in mice. And what we found was a shift in the ratio of neurons and glial cells in what's called the dentate gyrus. It's a region of the hippocampus that's critical for learning and memory. One of the things it does is discriminate between similar memories, past memories versus new, which is critical in order to function. And this ability is very important for cognitive flexibility, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. And so what we found was there was a specific shift in neuroglial ratio in HAR123 knockout mice in this dentate gyrus region, the so-called gateway cells that convey information from the cerebral cortex to other portions of the hippocampus. And whereas we did not see a shift in neural glial ratio in other regions of the brain, including what I'm showing here. So given that HAR123 knockout has effect on neural glial ratio in mice, we then wanted to know, does it have a role in their behavior? We were disappointed to find that HAR123 knockout mice were normal in most respects. However, we did one test that led to another test that showed a difference between wild type and HAR123 knockout mice. Probably many of you are familiar with this test. It's the water maze test. And the idea is you put mice into a pool of milky water that has a submerged platform. And the mice cannot see the platform because the water is milky. And so when you put them in, they swim around. Mice don't really like to swim, but they swim if they have to. And they kind of go around aimlessly until they finally find the platform, and then they can rest. And so you, on subsequent days, you put them in again and again, and they learn where the platform is. And by the eighth trial in this example shown in this picture, they go straight to the platform so that they can rest happily. And our knockout mice were as good as wild type at learning in this test. This is the target quadrant versus the other quadrants. And you can see that after, in our, this case, four trials, both our knockout mice and the control mice learned just nice, very nicely. But then Amanda Roberts, who ran these tests, she's at the Scripps Research Institute, she said, okay, let's try the relearning test. And the relearning test, you basically move the cue that tells the mouse where the platform is. It's too much trouble to move the platform. So they move the cue. And now a normal mice has to relearn. They have to learn that the platform is shifted. Well, the wild-type mice, as expected, did relearn in a statistically significant way. But our knockout mice did not. And we showed the same thing with another test called the Barnes-Maze test. Very exact same concept. And so basically, this data together suggests that Harlan 2-3 is critical for cognitive flexibility. There are many examples of it, but just to give one example, if there is a lot of traffic going the way that you normally go to work, you know, you make a shift and you come up with an alternative route to go to work. And it would appear that, at least in mice, HAR123 is critical for this function. Okay, so up till now, I've been talking about what HAR123 does biologically. But let's go back to the original HAR hypothesis, and that is that HARs are supposed to confer human-specific traits. At least that's the central idea. Unfortunately, to date, no HAR, to my knowledge, has been definitively shown to confer a human-specific trait. It's an ongoing road that many of us are on, but to date, nobody has achieved that. What about HAR123? Might it confer a human-specific neural trait? Well, before we can answer that question, we need to first determine, has human HAR123 evolved properties that differ from HAR123 from our closest living ancestor, chimp HAR123? And so let me just briefly go over some of the evidence that indeed they do differ. So one difference is the enhancer assay I showed you before in developing mouse embryos. What we found is that the human HAR123 tends to act in the developing forebrain in a mouse embryo, whereas the chimp version tends to act in the hindbrain. So they seem to have different spatial properties. They both turn on genes in the brain, but in different regions. I should say, by the way, that they both activate genes in the midbrain region, but they differ with regard to frontal and hindbrain activities. To discover possible other differences between the two, what we did is we went back to our human embryonic stem cells and we replaced the human version of HAR123, which is in human embryonic stem cells, with a chimp version using CRISPR. And one of the things we found is that these chimp HAR123 knock-in ES cells differed from wild type in their ability to form neural progenitor cells. Don't have time to go into the details, but in brief, there was a difference in the efficiency of formation of neural progenitor cells, and there were also differences in the specific cell subsets that were produced. Importantly, going back to a topic I talked about a little bit earlier, the knock-in ES cells and wild-type ES cells differed in the ratio of neurons and glia that they formed. And this has lots of implications, including, as I mentioned earlier, it might indicate that HAR123 has a role in the known difference in neural glial ratio between humans and chimps in the prefrontal cortex. Another line of evidence came from our work on the mechanism of HAR123 and how it promotes neural progenitor formation. So in brief, we found that HAR123 directly activates the neighboring gene called HIC1, which encodes a transcriptional repressor. And through rescue experiments, we showed that this then drives neuroprogenitor generation. HIC1 is not the only intermediary in this circuit, but it is a critical one. Importantly, we found that only human HAR123, not the chimp or the mouse orthologs of HAR123, are able to activate HIC transcription. So it suggests, and I want to emphasize suggests, certainly does not prove, that there's a human-specific circuit driving neuroprogenitor formation that involves HAR123 and HIC1. And lastly, we found that not only HIC1 is uniquely regulated by human HAR123, but also the genes shown here. These are all uniquely regulated by human HAR123, not the chimp or mouse orthologs of HAR123. What I think is particularly exciting is we found that about one half of these are not just involved in the brain, but in specifically neural development. And so this suggests the possibility or supports the possibility that HAR influences one or more human-specific neurodevelopmental traits. So in summary, today I have talked about a little sequence that's evolutionarily ancient that has rapidly evolved specifically in the human lineage. Our work has led to the following model. Human HAR123 drives the expression of HIC1, a neighboring gene, which drives neural progenitor formation. And then HAR123 also alters the ratio of neurons and glial cells that are produced from these neural progenitors. And according to our model, this in turn then affects cognitive flexibility. Chimp HAR123 does not, according to our data, regulate HIC1. But it does also affect neural progenitor formation and the ratio of neurons to glial cells, but by a different mechanism. And we think, according to our model, differs subtly in human HAR123, ultimately in its effects, such as on cognitive flexibility. I'd like to acknowledge Kendall Higgins, a former master's student who started this project off. A big thanks to Kung Tan, an assistant professor in the lab who did more than 95% of the work on this project. Ching Lu, who provided technical support, and a big thanks to Amanda Roberts at Scripps, who, as I mentioned, conducted all the behavioral studies that I talked about today. Thank you very much.